And Russia's president declares a day of mourning and vows to punish whoever ordered the shooting at the concert hall. And welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gizum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Nearly 6 months into the Israeli genocidal war on the Gaza Strip, the regime's relentless bombardment and shelling continues to claim lives of innocent people in the Palestinian territory. Several areas, including Jabalia in the north and Rafah in the south, have come under fresh aerial strikes. At least 30 people were killed in Israeli shelling as aid was being distributed in Gaza. Bombing of a residential building claimed several civilian lives in Deir al-Bala. The Gaza Health Ministry says 114 Palestinians lost their lives in Israeli strikes in a matter of 24 hours. The death toll from the U.S.-backed genocide in Gaza since October the 7th has now surpassed 32,100, most of them women and children. 7,000 more are unaccounted for and feared dead under the rubble of their homes. Over 74,400 Gazans have also been injured. Almost 6 months of Israeli bombings continue to claim the lives of innocent Gazans. Families of victims of the latest Israeli attack talk about their situation.
They're asleep at 1 o'clock and the house started shaking. 8 people were killed. This is a shame. They were all children, 5 children and a father and mother. They were all children. They hadn't done anything. What happened to them is unjust. This is a shame. My message is find a solution to what's happening to us. We are tired. Or they should hit us with a bomb and relieve us of this world. This is a shame. What's happening here does not happen to humans. This is not normal. This is a disaster on the whole world. No one is doing anything or finding a solution to this situation. How much longer do we have to endure this? There is unbelievable pressure on us. People cannot be silent about us to this extent. Shame on them. The things that are happening to us are shameful.
Can you see what is happening to us? Every day we have 200, 150, 170, 700, 300, 400 martyrs daily. Until when are you going to just look at us? Until when is the Arab world going to just look at us? What does the world want from us? Come and rescue us from the genocide that Netanyahu and his group have inflicted on us.
The house was struck when people were sleeping. They were children and innocent people, not affiliated with any factions. They are innocent civilians and children. We pulled them in pieces. It is considered a safe zone. There is no threat here. We are supposed to be safe here. People were targeted at 1 a.m. when they were asleep.
People were sitting down for suhoor when suddenly there was a huge explosion. My house is not far away, about 50 meters from here, so I came and saw that a fire had broken out in the house of these people. They were displaced people who had come from the north and taken refuge in the south, a mother and 6 children.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, on a visit to the doorstep of the war-ravaged Gaza, has appealed for a ceasefire and delivery of aid into the territory.
Nothing justifies the collective punishment of the Palestinian people. Now more than ever, it is time for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. It is time to silence the guns. Palestinians in Gaza, children, women, men, remain stuck in a non-stop nightmare.
Guterres was speaking in a visit to Rafah crossing on the Egypt-Palestine border. He described the long-time blockaded relief trucks on one side of the gate and starving Palestinians on the other as a moral outrage. The UN chief said the choice was between increasing aid or starvation. Guterres said the continuation of the war will make the humanitarian situation worse. He also warned Israel against launching a ground operation in Rafah. The Gaza Strip is struggling with severe shortages in food, water, and medication and fuel. Israel has blocked the entry of almost all essentials into the besieged territory, including foodstuff, medicine, and water, since the regime began its genocidal war on October 7th. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says it has carried out an operation against two Israeli military sites during using over 60 rockets. Hezbollah said its new operation targeted Israel's missile and artillery base in Yoav and the Kayla barracks in the occupied Golan Heights. The movement said that the operation came in retaliation for Israel's earlier bombing of the Lebanese city of Baalbek and in support of Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip. The movement has been attacking Israel's military sites since the regime began its genocide in Gaza early last October. Meanwhile, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq also announced a new anti-Israeli attack in support of Gaza. It said the operation targeted the headquarters of the regime's Ministry of Military Affairs with a drone. Thousands of Israeli protesters have once again taken to the streets of Tel Aviv calling for the resignation of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and new elections.
The corrupt government is declining to bring the sides to a negotiating table and close a deal to return the hostages. And we believe that the government has to go because this is the government that led us into the war, that led us to a point of complacency, and will not be able to take us to a place of progress.
I think it's crazy, but they are sticking so strongly to their seats. It's like a glue that you can't take off. So the politics is above everything these days. Unfortunately, and in spite of everything, it's crazy. You would have thought that by now that we would have a new government, but this is not happening. They're so strong politically, and their different interests are holding them together. And it's shocking. It's shocking. But we'll continue with the protest.
Israeli protesters who were heading towards the regime's Ministry of Military Affairs chanted slogans while carrying anti-Netanyahu placards. They also carried a Netanyahu effigy in prison uniform. In some areas, protesters blocked the streets. They also pulled on fire hoses to prevent the firefighters from reaching bonfires they had made on the streets. The regime forces tried to disperse the demonstrators using force. The protesters also demanded a deal with the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas to release all the Israeli captives. A similar protest was also held outside Netanyahu's residence in the occupied city of Al-Quds. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has denounced Friday's shooting in the capital Moscow as a bloody and barbaric terrorist attack. He said everyone behind the terror attack will be punished. At least 133 people were killed when gunmen attacked the packed concert venue on the outskirts of Moscow. The city governor says the death toll is expected to rise significantly. Marina Kurtunova reports from Moscow.
Russian President Vladimir Putin addressed the nation after the deadly attack in Moscow, which killed dozens of civilians. The president denounced the massacre as a bloody and barbaric terrorist attack, as he declared March 24, a national day of mourning. At least 11 suspects, including four perpetrators who directly participated in the shooting spree, have been arrested. The four direct perpetrators were detained in Bryansk region. According to the intelligence service, the terrorists planned to cross the Russian-Ukrainian border. The Russian president vowed to punish all involved in the massacre.
All the perpetrators, organizers, and customers of this crime will suffer fair and inevitable punishment, whoever they are, whoever guides them. I repeat, we will identify and punish everyone who stands behind the terrorists, who prepared this atrocity, this attack on Russia, on our people.
The Daesh Takfiri terror group claimed responsibility, but Moscow has dismissed the claim, asserting that investigation is still underway to ascertain the main culprits. Russia's security service says the Moscow attackers had contacts in Ukraine supporting them. During interrogation, a detained terrorist said he was promised 5,000 rubles to carry out the terrorist attack. He claimed he watched a certain preacher on Telegram and allegedly his assistant contacted the man.
The perpetrators are ignorant, illiterate people who will commit any crime for money. The question is different. Where is the planning center? Not a single international organization can act in the international arena, especially in a state like Russia, where there are strong power structures. Performers can be found anywhere through the agents. We went through this experience in Chechnya. This once again convinces us that international terrorist structures are the work of the CIA and Western intelligence services.
The attack, which came amid Ukraine's war with Russia, was the deadliest in the country since the Beslan school siege in 2004. After Friday's attack, Putin held discussion with his Belarusian counterpart Alexander Lukashenko. Both leaders confirmed their readiness to work together in the fight against terrorism.
In his address, President Putin said Moscow attackers were preparing to flee towards Ukraine, where a window had been prepared for them with the help of Ukraine. Now it remains to be seen how Russia is going to react to the massacre, which came in a very volatile region and amid its war against Ukraine. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Eyewitnesses recount the horror of Friday's terror attack and how they survived through it. Let's take a listen.
I tried to hide behind the speaker because there were people with guns in the parterre. I personally saw one person with some kind of weapon with a long barrel. I don't know what it was, a machine gun or something. The pops were like firecrackers. We were lying down. I was trying to crawl behind the speaker because it was really scary. You could hear bullets whistling. You could hear gunfire. We were all trying to lie down to avoid being shot at.
I was right there on the west side of the shopping mall. Suddenly I heard sounds like firecrackers, but had no clue what was actually happening. Then I saw loads of people running. They told me in Russian that there was a shooting or something, but I still don't know what happened. So I came to this hill on the west side of the mall following the first bunch of retreating folks. As we are about 700 meters away from the mall, we should be safe for now.
We felt something was burning as it began to spread from the basement and started to rise upwards. As the hall itself is located from below upwards, the fabric began to ignite, apparently filling the air supply system, causing it to settle downwards. As we were running, I noticed pools of blood and blood stains on the ground floor.
Earlier, we discussed the Moscow terror attack and its aftermath with our guests in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this news review. Out of Moscow, Mimi Adlaham, journalist and activist, and out of Pittsburgh, Daniel Kovalik, author and activist. Thank you both for being with me. Well, let's start it off in Moscow. And Mimi, your thoughts, because on the one hand, we hear that Daesh has said that they were responsible for this. On the other hand, we're hearing out of Moscow that they're not accepting that Daesh are actually the culprits. Your take on this and your thoughts why Russia is saying this?
Well, I think, you know, for decades now, ISIS has been acting on behalf of the CIA. It's not a coincidence that every, and not only the CIA, you know, when I say CIA, I also mean Mossad. It's not a coincidence that every country that the U.S. wants to destroy happens to also face a large battalion of ISIS destroying the country also. And this is just part and parcel with that. The reason this time is so suspicious, so blatant, that the Russian government isn't going to play games and isn't going to pretend it's just a random ISIS attack is because, you know, it's been years since ISIS has done any kind of attack like this. ISIS was pretty much almost completely defeated. And so this comes at a time, like, right after the Russian elections, right when, you know, the battlefield was accelerating in Ukraine, right after Victoria Nuland threatened more money to Ukraine and nasty surprises for Putin and asymmetric warfare. This is after the, you know, Netanyahu threatened Russia. There was also other Likud party members that were threatening Russia on RT because Russia has taken a closer stance to Palestine. They brought the Palestinian resistance into Moscow recently, just this month. And so all of these factors point to the NATO-Israel-CIA sort of axis of evil perpetrating this attack on Moscow as a form of saying, we're going to bring the war to you. It's not just going to, it's going to affect the heartland of Russia.
Well, Daniel, your take, I mean, with, like, in any situation when a crime is committed, we look at who benefits and who does it hurt. So your take on this, who would benefit from this type of terrorist attack? And in your perspective, who's most likely behind it?
Yes, well, it's always, honestly, I can't conceive of who could benefit from it. I mean, obviously, Ukraine has been carrying out attacks against civilians in towns like Belgorod, Russia, and even against people in the new regions of Russia, formerly Ukraine. So they certainly seem to have the motivation to do that sort of thing. Though how it benefits them, it's hard for me to conceive of. I think this is only going to rally the Russian people behind the government and really strengthen their resolve. I think in the end, if Ukraine was behind this, and I think they may have been, it's a death sentence for them.
Okay, and of course, we heard from President Putin today that said definitely the perpetrators will be responded to. Thank you both for being with me on this news review. Mimi Alaham, journalist and activist out of Moscow, and Daniel Kovalek out of Pittsburgh. And thank you for being with us on another news review, and thanks so much for staying with us.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
Alongside Iranians in Nowruz.
In the name of God, salam everybody, welcome to the program. Today is the fourth day of Nowruz holidays. Congratulations on this ancient Iranian feast. As we said yesterday, today we will speak about the customs of Kurds during Nowruz. Kurds are scattered mainly in Kermanshah, Kurdistan, Ilam, and parts of West Azerbaijan and North Khorasan provinces. Stay with us, please. Kurds are one of the old Iranian ethnicities who speak Kurdish language. Kurdish language includes various dialects such as Kurmanji, Sorani, Kalhor, Oromani, Guran, and Lak. The last one is in fact a mixture of Kurdish language and Lori dialect. Nowruz is the greatest feast among Kurds. They wear new clothes and hold various artistic and cultural events to welcome Nowruz. Kurds start Khune Tekuni several days before Nowruz. The most important thing in the villages is to renew walls with plaster as they have been blackened with soot during winter. Then carpets and rugs are beaten outdoors to remove dust. However, if it is sunny, they are washed. Mir Nowruzi or Amir Bahari is a show which Kurds hold before the turn of year. It is held on the last Wednesday of year. People choose one from among themselves as a temporary governor and call him Mir Nowruzi. The governor is the ruler of city or village and runs the affairs during Nowruz. At the end of Nowruz, he gets the title of king. Interestingly, he's not allowed to laugh during his rule. He shouldn't laugh at the sweet stories he himself recounts. If he laughs or even smiles, he will be dismissed by the locals. However, his commands, which are mainly for gladdening people, should be put into action in the best way. The elderly and elite in the city provide him and his near ones with sword, dagger, and whatever he needs. This custom is now held only symbolically and has lost its past prevalence. Kurdish people attach high respect to the deceased. The day before the turn of year, or the last Thursday, they go to the graveyard and recite prayer and Fatiha, that is, chapter Hamd of the Noble Quran, for the spirits of the dead. As it is customary in many regions of Iran, relatives take new clothes for the bereaved family and ask them to change their black garments with the new ones. Moreover, the neighbors of the bereaved family do not make fire of Nowruz in respect for them. It is nice custom among Kurds that they take gifts for the new bride and her family. These gifts and presents are taken by the groom's family. The pack of gifts is called khanche and includes sugar cone, clothes, perfume, mirror, nuts, fruits, pastries, and even food. Kurds also celebrate Nowruz and other happy ceremonies with halpark, which is rhythmic show, performed in circles with others. Halpark music is very beautiful and rhythmic. It reminds of valor and combat. It is performed very harmoniously. Well, dear listeners, unlike other ethnicities, haft-seen tablecloth is not that popular among Kurdish people. They gather together and congratulate Nowruz to each other. Men often pay a visit to the elite and elderly. Kurds, like other Iranians, go to parks, gardens, and mountain feet for picnic on the 13th day of Nowruz, Siste Bedar, to end their holidays with nature and take new energy from it for the rest of the year. They make preparations the day before and early in the morning of the 13th day. Leave for picnic. It is customary to perform Hall Park on this day too. As for the food on the day of nature, a variety of foods are prepared on the day. But in the city of Sanandaj, a kind of kebab is very popular. Some families also make kalana. Kalana is famous as Kurdish pizza and dates back to some 3,000 years to be the first fast food in the world. Others prepare dolme berg or stuffed grape leaves. There are other customs too in Kurdish inhabiting regions in Iran. For instance, in Divandare, families drop out every old thing to ward off bad luck. In some villages, sheep or goats are slaughtered.
Welcome to Israel Watch. On this episode, we will monitor the course of the aggression against the Gaza Strip and the failure to remove the resistance in light of the discrepancy between Biden and Netanyahu over the management of the aggression and the disagreements within Netanyahu's administration. We'll also go over the Zionist fear about the exacerbation of the situation in the holy month of Ramadan. On these topics, I welcome Mr. Ali Murad, the political researcher and writer. Welcome, Professor. Let's start with this. Although Iran corrected the Hebrew media's allegations about an Iranian presence in the Gaza Strip through the Iranian Red Crescent, and Tehran confirmed that Iranian aid was brought into the Strip through coordination with the Egyptian Red Crescent, Zionist commentators began to fear this step. Professor Ali Murad, why do the Zionists insist that the entry of Iranian humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip, which is primarily in coordination with Egypt, represents an Iranian presence in the Strip, knowing that dozens of countries usually send such aid as we see?
Well, of course, since the beginning of the Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, since the first hours, there has been an attack of accusations against the Islamic Republic of Iran. And we witnessed that in the speech of Netanyahu and all the Zionist political elite, and at every station. They are trying to target the Islamic Republic of Iran, and I believe that the Zionist regime in general is trying to impose a fait accompli on the Gaza Strip so that in the next stage it can completely isolate Palestine from the rest of the axis of resistance. This is a central goal for the war administration. Therefore, they will try to target anyone would make this Israeli effort fail. Yes, it is a very good thing that the Islamic Republic of Iran's aid succeeds in reaching the Gazans. This destroys all the enemy's attempts to isolate the Gazans. Gaza is the incubator of the resistance and depicts the depth of the axis of resistance.
There is a lot of talk in the Hebrew media these days about Majid Farage, the head of the intelligence in the Palestinian Authority, because he is, according to this media, qualified to build an armed force from the families and tribes of Gaza to manage this part in a civilized manner, and it was revealed that he has met with a group of senior Zionist security officials. The Hebrew media talked about Majid Farage's meeting with Hagenbi, which was preceded by a heated discussion about Netanyahu and Gallant within the War Council, about the role he could play with the Palestinian Authority in distributing aid in the Gaza Strip. Professor Ali Murad, in your opinion, do you think there is a role for Majid Farage in the Gaza Strip or even Mohammed Dahlan, as we saw as Minister of War Gallant said under the main title Distribution of Aid?
It is true and clear that there is a Zionist attempt to seek help from those two figures or any of them. It is clear that they have no problem in the sense that they are reassuring for both parties. By Majid Farage and Mohammed Dahlan, Netanyahu is trying to play a game that he does not want anything from the Palestinian Authority. He does not want to allow its return to the Gaza Strip because they are concerned that they will fail in the process of suppressing the return of the resistance movement and the resurgence of the resistance factions. I believe that in the coming period, we will hear more about the role that Majid Farage will play in this context. Of course, there is a very great deal of acceptance with Mr. Majid Farage and also with Mohammed Dahlan. And there is practically a competition between which party plays a more important role. But for Majid Farage to meet with Hanegbi, the Israeli war advisor, this means there is a preference for Israeli expansion, preferring to work with the intelligence services directly affiliated with the authority. Yes, Dahlan may have a complementary role in another route through the Emirates, while the well-known side means Majid Farage represents the authority that is included within the official directions of the Arab League, Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt.
It is clear that the campaigns against the Netanyahu administration are continuing with force from its opposition, as former Minister of War Victor Berman called for its overthrow because the war is over, as he puts it. In addition, the Israelis have no choice but to go to new elections to overthrow the bad and dangerous Netanyahu administration. This is what the head of the Zionist opposition, Yair Lapid, called for. If the elections were held today, Gantz would gain a lead over Netanyahu. This is what a new Israel poll showed. Mr. Ali Morad, there are calls for elections by Lapid and Lieberman, and also the opinion polls clearly indicate that Gantz has a lead over Netanyahu. Do you think that it is actually possible to go to elections in light of the failure to achieve the declared goals of this aggression against the Gaza Strip?
It's clear that there is an American tendency in the Biden administration that the collective interest is to go to early elections in the sense of overthrowing Netanyahu, overthrowing his administration, and setting an early date for the elections. For the Americans, they consider that there is a danger to interests today represented by some of Netanyahu's policies. Therefore, on the issue of, for example, going to Rafah, they oppose it because they know that if Netanyahu goes to Rafah in 4 or 6 weeks, he will come out and say, "I have achieved a decisive victory militarily, and I'm not obligated to sign anything within the political project." So they have now launched the attack. We witnessed statements from within Washington that were met with statements from within the Zionist regime. Lapid, Lieberman, and all of these, even summoning Gantz to Washington, is in order to try to float him and market him as the right man to repair relations with America.
Indeed, with the opinion polls favoring Gantz's lead over Netanyahu, a campaign emerged by some politicians, represented by the coup of Gideon Sa'ar, head of one of the Zionist parties, against Gantz and demanding that he should join the war council. So what effect will this coup by Gideon Sa'ar have on Gantz, and how will Netanyahu exploit it politically?
First, we must pay attention to the issue of Gideon Sa'ar. He grew up alongside Netanyahu and is therefore Netanyahu's dark horse. When he broke away from him years ago and joined the so-called international camp towards Gantz, it was destined at a certain stage for Netanyahu to return him towards himself so that he would break the reaction to Gantz's trip to the United States of America and what he said there and this American attempt to market Gantz as the strong man. Now, Netanyahu responds to his blows through his charm, thus showing Gantz that you are nothing. I can dismantle all the orientation that you are trying to build in an interview.
While the occupation leaders continue their threats to remove the resistance in the Gaza Strip, they were surprised by two Palestinian resistance fighters who were diving, coming from the Gaza Strip across the sea towards the Zakin settlement in the Gaza Strip, which has caused a state of terror reminiscent of the Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. The occupation army cannot control the Gaza Strip and establish military rule there, as ministers in Netanyahu's administration call for after the end of the aggression. This was confirmed by one of the former Zionist generals. The soldiers of the occupation army in the Gaza Strip are tired and desperate, and talk of an attack on Rafah is not in the interest of the Israelis. This was expressed by one of the commentators in the Hebrew media. With regard to the arrival of resistance divers to the shores of the Zakum settlements and the fatigue of the occupation soldiers, the inability to attack Rafah and the military control over the Gaza Strip, what is the military reality like in the Gaza Strip?
This means that there is an attempt by the resistance to tame the enemy by putting pressure on the public psychologically. The Israeli public, the public that is still lining up behind Netanyahu, or most of them are lining up behind Netanyahu and are still supporting him in the continuation of the war. The resistance is in fact telling them that unlike what Netanyahu has told you about cleaning up and settling the north, now this is a clearing operation from the Gazan land to the sea to Zikim. As the Zionist correspondent pointed out, this indicates that they have restored the scene on October 7th. This means that everything you did during the past 5 to 6 months has been in vain and you have not achieved anything. Hamas still has its capabilities. You say you have destroyed Hamas, and then you say you have destroyed Hamas's capabilities. But Hamas proves to everyone that their capabilities are still preserved. And therefore this would put the ball back in the Zionist court, creating a debate that grows within the opposition bloc to stop the war. I mean, this war is absurd and has not achieved its goals. Amos Gilad, a former member of the planning department in the enemy army, says and advises, speaking in addition to other generals, that you cannot control this region. This region is finished, meaning it is no longer the way it was in 2005 when you left it. When you withdrew from it, there is great resistance that will occupy you and exhaust you.
Therefore, skepticism about the ability of the occupation army to achieve victory over the resistance in the Gaza Strip is accompanied by the confirmations about Hamas's victory and the occupation's defeat in the eyes of the world, which today focuses on the beginning of the month of Ramadan and its effect on the path of aggression. To the Israeli social media sites that responded to this statement, these are some of the comments.
Aout. Yes, I agree that Netanyahu is procrastinating the war because of his greed and does not care about returning the captives.
Timur.
They're all politicians and their leaders are enemies who are playing with us.
Nuiyuson.
The truth is that the biggest reason for our failure in the war is Netanyahu.
Niv.
Netanyahu creates division and hatred among the people.
Liron.
There's no greater enemy of Israel than Netanyahu.
Professor Ali Murad, how do you explain the call to seize the opportunity of the current American administration to make an achievement against the axis of resistance in the region?
This shows the importance given to this approach and seizing this opportunity, because what Biden presented today was not presented by an American president before him. He's the one who chose to visit Israel at the beginning of the war, and this has not happened before. None of the American presidents visited the enemy region at such a time. This indicates the depth of the commitment that Biden has. Commitment to the security of Israel and the survival of Israel, and for Israel to return to its feet and all of these things. Today, there are groups within the Zionist regime that tell the Netanyahu administration that they see in the Americans in the current administration a savior and a guide who can be followed, in contrast to the choices that Benjamin Netanyahu wants to take them to, most of which stem from his own personal interests. This trend is growing. We are watching on the television channels, especially channels 12 and 13. There is a focus on this point, meaning that if we continue in this manner, we will lose the United States of America permanently.
The relationship between Biden and Netanyahu became tense after the U.S. intelligence reports indicated that Netanyahu cannot remain prime minister for long. The emergence of this dispute between Biden and Netanyahu will not only harm the relationship between the two sides, but may harm American arms shipments to the regime. Professor Ali Morad, the CIA report regarding Benjamin Netanyahu, in your opinion, will it really affect U.S. arms shipments to the regime?
Biden dismissed this idea since the beginning of the war, in the middle of the war, and until recently yesterday, that he will not allow arms shipments to Israel to stop. This matter is settled. The issue here only deals with the person of Netanyahu and Biden, who has been trying for some time to address the Zionist public and say to them, I care about my paternal feelings towards you, I care about Israel's security, and this concern for Israel's security and Israel's survival pushes me to differentiate between Israel's security interests and Netanyahu's interests. What was stated in the intelligence report on security threats regarding Netanyahu specifically is clear that it is a great light for a current within the regime to take actions. It is saying to them that now is an appropriate time for you to begin your movements against Netanyahu because Biden does not want to put pressure on him directly. He prefers this pressure to be exerted on him and his affiliates from within the regime. Therefore, he says these things that we have sovereignty and we're moving and we're not a banana republic and all this talk.
Writer and political researcher Professor Ali Morad, thank you very much for your participation in this episode of Israel Watch, and thank you for your good follow-up. Take care.
Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz. On behalf of myself and all my colleagues here at IRIB English Radio, we wish you a wonderful Nowruz, full of happiness and prosperity.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, continue the holy month of Ramadan for the rest of the year in our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So dear friends, we are talking about how we must continue the holy month of Ramadan throughout the rest of the year in our Islamic lifestyle. Now, you must be wondering, why are we talking about this when we are, you know, approximately around halfway through the holy month of Ramadan? We should be talking about this towards the end of the holy month of Ramadan. Well, you know, we have a tendency at A to Z to really think about things a little more profoundly. So, for example, when the holy month of Ramadan is ending and we start to talk about, you know, the things that you should have learned or you should have kept in mind in the holy month of Ramadan, well, it's over. What's the benefit of talking about those things at the end of the holy month of Ramadan? So that's why we thought, why don't we talk about these things in the middle of the holy month of Ramadan? And perhaps it could be said we should have talked about them in the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, but we didn't want to overwhelm, you know, all you listeners out there at that point in time. So still, we have a good, solid, probably 2 weeks left in the holy month of Ramadan. You know, we should have been accustomed by now to fasting and to the hunger and thirst, even though perhaps you can never be really accustomed to it. But, you know, at least after 2 weeks, we're kind of, you know, cruise control, and we are understanding what's happening with us. And so at this point, we really need to start to actively think about all of the things that we have been able to master and control, and all of the things that we have been able to inculcate and implement in our Islamic lifestyle.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back, dear friends. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about how we need to take those things which we learn in the holy month of Ramadan and apply them throughout the rest of our lives and the rest of the year so that we really live that ideal Islamic lifestyle that we are all trying to reach. This is something that is a personal thing in the sense where we should sit down, we should think about all the things that we are learning. For example, you know, most probably and first and foremost, primarily, we have learned that we are able to spiritually overcome our physical and most basic necessities and needs, such as eating and drinking, you know, for relatively long periods of time and over, you know, 29 or 30 days, depending on the sighting of the moon this year. So, you know, we have been able to overcome these basic and very primal desires, you know. And so this is, again, one of the things that we learn every single year. And it's one of the things that we hear every single year, that we are so strong and we are so powerful and we have such a capability that if our spirit and our soul wants to control something, it can control something. It just takes dedication and willpower and intention and sincerity and, of course, a great deal of help from the Almighty Allah. So we don't really have a lot of time, just a few seconds left on the program, at least on my behalf. So please take this into consideration. Sit down and write all of the things that we have learned. Write all of the things that we have been able to accomplish in this holy month of Ramadan so that we can continue those things throughout the rest of our lives and throughout the rest of the year so that we can attain, inshallah, that beautiful, pure, and blessed Islamic lifestyle. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
You lift me up high, you spread my wings and fly me to the sky. I so alive, it's like my soul thrives in your light. But how I wish you'd be here with me all year around. Ramadan, 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 ya Habib.
In Gaza, we're no longer on the brink of famine, we're in a state of famine, affecting thousands of people. The words of EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. I'm Saeed Pourreza. On this program, day three of ceasefire talks in Doha between an Israeli delegation and mediators from Qatar, the U.S., and Egypt. The Qataris say they're cautiously optimistic, but a breakthrough is too early to talk about. Meanwhile, hunger has reached catastrophic levels as a result of the Israeli siege of Gaza. The World Health Organization says an increasing number of children in Gaza are on the brink of death from acute hunger. Canada joins the Netherlands, Japan, Spain, and Belgium in suspending arms sales to the genocidal Israeli regime. But several Western countries continue to supply lethal weapons to Tel Aviv, despite the enormous human toll and an imminent famine in Gaza. The bulk of those weapons, of course, supplied by the U.S., Israel's closest ally. After nearly more than 5 months of the genocidal campaign, the death toll is at least 32,000 and more than 74,000 wounded. With us for this edition of the program, in the studio, Dr. Imran Ali Panjwani. Dr. Panjwani is head of diverse legal consulting and a senior lecturer in law. And via Skype from London is Dr. Nehat Khanfar, who is also a lecturer in law and politics. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. I'd like to start with you, Dr. Panjwani, and it's become a tradition to really start with getting our guests' reflections on more than 31,000 killed, over 70,000 wounded, the scale of the death and destruction in the Gaza Strip, and of course, as I read earlier, the imminent famine that is facing the population there.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think two immediate points come to our mind. One is, since our last discussion, which was specifically about the ICJ ruling, there appears not to have been a follow-up there, or perhaps South Africa is trying to do that. And so there doesn't appear to be legal limits based on international law to stop the genocide, to stop the massacre. That's the first thing. So legally, the first reflection I have is, how are we putting legal pressure on Israel? And number two is, historically, I mean, this is the worst genocide since Rwanda. The death toll keeps rising. And even though we are in Ramadan and we are fasting, there doesn't appear to be any sense of humanity and decency to stop the killing and give food to people who are starving and also fasting.
And South Africa has recently asked the ICJ to do more, which is to call for a ceasefire.
Yes, exactly. But there doesn't appear to be a legal follow-up in terms of implementation of the court ruling, because they said, okay, you have this by this date to report. So, okay, what are the next legal measures? How are we going to enforce the ruling? I think these are the more fundamental questions.
Dr. Khanfar, we'll get to, of course, the core issue of the stumbling blocks to achieving a ceasefire, but can I just have your thoughts on how necessary and how urgent a cessation in violence is, especially as we heard Dr. Panjwani say earlier, during the holy month of Ramadan?
Well, we have to look at what Netanyahu thinks, as a matter of fact. We shouldn't really treat Netanyahu as a normal politician in this political world. We have to treat Netanyahu in a very unique and specific case, because he wanted to position himself to be the man that he can break all the political red lines and sending a message to all world that I am the one, really, that you can't expect me to stop at any of these red lines that you have promoted or you have drawn for any other politician in this world. And of course, Netanyahu, in this case, because he always promoted himself to be the man of security, failing to deliver on that, he feels that he has really to do anything just to have any caption of victory. And it seems to be all what he can really do in that regard is just really killing more Palestinians and putting all his efforts to weaponize anything he can does, even challenging the American administration, Biden administration. It's coming in the same context. It is all about how Netanyahu is trying really to to promote a new design of his own image, political image, in order just to send a message for his own fascist extreme right voters to tell them, I am the man who can really do whatever he wants just to protect so-called Israeli security.
And total victory, I think, is the phrase they have used against the resistance group in the Gaza Strip. Well, let's talk ceasefires now. Qatar says it remains cautiously optimistic about the possibility of reaching a ceasefire agreement between the resistance group Hamas and Israel, and that it's too early still to announce any successes. Foreign Ministry spokesman Majid Al-Ansari says Israeli Mossad intelligence chief David Barnea has left Doha and that technical negotiations are ongoing between Israel and Hamas, with Qatar once more playing mediator between the parties. Well, here is Majid Al-Ansari addressing journalists at a news conference in Doha.
I don't think we are at a moment now where we can say that we are close to a deal. We are, as I said, we are cautiously optimistic because the talks have resumed, and that is a good thing, and we hope that that continues, and we hope to build upon that in the coming days, but it's still too early to announce any successes. First of all, to put you all at ease, he has left Doha, according to the information I have, and the technical teams are still meeting here in Doha. We do believe, of course, and we have said this countless times, that any attack on Rafah would hamper any efforts to get a deal. It would be a humanitarian catastrophe within what is happening right now in Gaza. We are talking about around 1.5 million Palestinians crammed into 10% of Gaza. We already have surpassed the number of 31,000 dead as a result of this war, and an attack of such magnitude will result in major death and destruction that cannot be justified by any tactical justifications that are being presented.
All right, the Qatari Foreign Ministry spokesman there. Dr. Panjwani, you mentioned earlier, of course, the lack of any action in terms of implementation as per South Africa's request of the ICJ calling for a ceasefire. What do you think are the most important stumbling blocks to reaching a deal now?
Well, I think the stumbling blocks are fundamentally political. So the issue is that within the Western Hemisphere, as you said, with the US and the UK, there isn't political support to put pressure on Israel, so the stopping of arms. Mm-hmm. With the implementation of the ICJ ruling, the theory behind international law, it sounds very nice. Okay, there you have the Genocide Convention, you have international human rights. International legally is known as a kind of tertiary or kind of supranational law. Mm-hmm. What that means is that it doesn't operate like a red traffic light. If you pass it, then you get a fine. Mm-hmm. Who are the international police? Who are the international safeguards that will, you know, slap you on the wrist and say, don't do this? We don't have that within international law. Oh. And the UN body is fundamentally political. So the stumbling blocks are that at the moment, the key players like US and UK are using political means to make sure that Israel is not held liable, despite what the legal text says.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Hanfar, you hear that there is, you talked about what, you know, to be able to think the way Netanyahu does, to know whether or not there will be a ceasefire, you'd have to see what Netanyahu has in mind, and you explained what he has in mind. But what is the significance of dissent within the Israeli war cabinet and public opinion, however minor that might be? We saw, for example, Gantz touring America, the U.S., Europe in recent weeks, apparently not coordinating with Netanyahu and all the rest of it. But what is the significance of that dissent in apartheid Israel, as far as this genocidal war continuing? In other words, to what extent do you think that would make any difference to what apartheid Israel is willing to concede in these ongoing negotiations?
Sadly and unfortunately, the vast majority of the voters in Israel backing Netanyahu's policies of continuing the genocide or genocidal actions against the Palestinians. And this is one of the recent surveys in many, as a matter of fact, in many of the the Israeli academic and journalistic investigations, the surveys, saying that the vast majority of the Israelis backing up every single bloodshed happening really in Gaza and in the West Bank, simply because they see it a good opportunity and they have to seize it and to carry on what they have started. They started to, you know, ethnically cleanse the Palestinians from the northern parts of Gaza. And now they are fighting in